And he hangs with one of his most well-known compositions, Listen Here. By the way, Eddie Harris is credited with creating the electrically amplified saxophone and other instruments as well. He died in 1996 at the age of 62. This is from his release in 1967, The Electrifying Eddie Harris, aptly titled, that album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and guess what? It's Free Your Mind Friday. I'm expecting you to free your mind today. Tell us what's on your mind, and let's see what we make of it. It's an opportunity for listeners to call in and speak frankly and openly about things that have been rustling around in their heads. And hopefully you have a point of view. Hopefully it's a strong point of view that we will appreciate. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. 888-874-4888. We're wasting no time. Up first is Henry from the Windy City of Chicago. Hey, Henry, how you doing?
How are you, Teresa? How's it going?
It's going. That's the main thing.
I know. Well, it's going here too. It's raining today, so.
So what are you freeing your mind of today?
All right. I wanted to wish you and the Lead Stories audience a safe and productive weekend. But I wanted to, I haven't talked much about this Derek Chauvin trial, except in regards to when you asked particular questions. But, you know, the absurdity of arguing if George Floyd was killed by his health instead of three cops being placed on him and basically suffocating him. And the video evidence, you know, being not sufficient enough to determine, you know, the cause of death is just, you know, it is just really, really, I mean, it takes me back to the Rodney King trial, where, you know, I think it may have been the first trial that there was video evidence of cops just literally beating, you know, just almost killing Rodney King. And everybody thinking back then, well, they got video evidence. And then the cops get off. Same thing with the Eric Garner trial. You know, cops don't even go to trial. The grand jury, you know, suggests that what the cops did was correct. So, and this is going down the same path. Now, I think before there was a caller who mentioned that there was no cop that was ever convicted of killing somebody. And I think somebody else had mentioned that there was one, and it was here in Chicago with Jason Van Dyke when he killed Laquan McDonald, pumping 16 bullets into the young child after he was down. And for a lot of us here, many people think that it wasn't the video evidence that got him convicted, but the fact that he lied on the report saying that, you know, he was a threat. But I feel like if the video evidence wasn't the one that convicted him. But, you know, I also, and that's what really concerns me about this trial, that, you know, Chauvin still may get a sentence like Jason Van Dyke, who got 7 years and eligible for parole in like 4 or 5 for second degree murder. That seems like that's going to be the outcome of Derek Chauvin if he gets convicted. But I also wanted to talk about earlier, you had a caller named Bob from Virginia. And I guess he was challenging you on, you know, about the chest having to expand in order to breathe. Well, I was listening to a parts of the pulmonologist report by a Dr. Martin Tobin, who is a pulmonologist. If nobody knows what a pulmonologist is, it's a doctor who deals with breathing. And he was in the business. He's actually still in the business for 40 years. He works here locally in Chicago at Loyola Hospital and Hines VA. And I want to give a brief quote on what he said, because I took this down. They asked him about the simplicity of breathing. And he said, this gets back, I quote, this is what he says. This gets back to how we breathe, and this is fairly simple. So the way we breathe, we have two big muscles that help us with breathing. We have the diaphragm, and we have the rib cage muscles. The diaphragm counts about 70% of what we need for breathing, and about 30% of it comes from the rib cage. And then when the diaphragm contracts or the rib cage contracts, they expand the chest. And when you expand the chest, then air flows in from and it's coming in, and that's all that happens on inspiration. End quote. So for a pulmonologist to say that chest expansion is critical to breathing, Utrice, I think you're right on this.
I just thought it was common sense. When sit, not only that, the chest is expanding, but then you had these cops sitting on Floyd's back. And that turns out to be a significant issue, according to the pulmonologist as well, that it depresses and it contracts the ability of the person breathing to continue breathing. Once the air is out, it stays out. Nothing comes back in. So that's what I was talking about that at that time,
but,
yes.
But you know, Utrice, that, like you said, that sounds like common sense, and he made it. I mean, he tried to make it seem like a seventh grade biology student would know this, and the chest doesn't have to expand. But you know, he's not probably the only one who thinks like this, and it is just absurd to think that, you know, having somebody's knee on that person's back while at the same time handcuffed, he's not going to have problems breathing. And so it takes a pulmonologist who has 40 years of experience, who is board certified by many national boards and medical institutions to come up with this, like you said, common sense theory that having his knee on his back and not letting the chest expand had nothing to do with his breathing. So I just wanted to plug that in because I thought that was very much crazy what he said earlier this week.
Well, I thank you so much too, because now I feel like, hey, I know a thing or two. I may look crazy, but I'm not. So, thanks a lot.
I appreciate it.
Jerry from New York, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Jerry. How are you?
Good. I was wondering if I could discuss like three things quickly and then we could discuss it. Just another point of view, in Georgia, there was a police guard who was moving a prisoner from one cell to another, and the prisoner was handcuffed. And I don't know how, but this prisoner got a knife, stabbed that prison guard to death, and stabbed another guard, but he is going to survive. Just like another point of view in terms of with policemen, I think they feel every time they're involved in an offense with somebody that I think they kind of go in with it with a life or death kind of approach, because they just never know what's going to happen. So you wouldn't think in a prison, a guy's handcuffed, that something like that would happen, but yet it led to the death of the prison guard. So I just think sometimes people have to have an awareness that with the Floyd or the whole thing, like you pull somebody over for a cracked headlight, cops end up dead because it just evolves into something else very quickly. The second point is that I understand this is a very important case, the Chauvin case, and there's a lot to it. The last call just brought up about the pulmonologist, and then today they'll have somebody on to discount it and say something else. It's very difficult and trying because it's a lot of, you have to sit there through all the information and really to get everything. But I feel that sometimes it would be nice if your show actually, this is such a divisive issue, if it could lead to maybe in a more positive light at times and go towards something that actually has a positive solution and brings people together, not so divisive. And I do have a question. Like, I'm really sorry that you had bad, encounters with white people. I've had racist things done to me by black people, but I don't judge every black person by that. I just move on and judge person by the individual. And according to government statistics, there are a lot of statistics that are not in favor of the black community committing crimes, especially 90% of violent crimes on white people are committed by blacks, the black on Asian crime, the black on black crime. And I don't know, you always call people, any white person does anything, as a white supremacist and a racist. And I don't like the whole identity thing, because then what would you call black people? Black supremacists? Like, I just feel as if we need to put all of those people who do the bad things, either as mentally disabled, mentally, something's wrong with their brain mentally, or they're just evil or criminals, instead of being the race war that we're, having things kind of go towards. Okay, I'm done.
How long have you been living in the United States?
My whole life.
Okay. It doesn't sound like it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you've been living in the United States for your whole life and you still do not appreciate the role of race and racism in this country, I have no advice for you. If it doesn't yet dawn on you that this is at the epicenter of our daily lives, it started this way. We didn't start it. We didn't create racism, did we? Did black people create racism in this country? Did Latinos?
No.
Did Asians?
Nope.
Okay. So why are you saying that now?
I'm not saying they created it.
Well, you're implying very strongly that whenever we have a problem of race, if you look a little deeper, you'll see that it's black people creating the problem. People are creating the problem of racism.
No, I'm not saying they're creating a problem of racism. I'm more come from a common sense approach and the way things have gotten in society, to me, things were getting better and better.
What do you mean by a common sense approach? How do you approach institutionalized experiences with common sense?
I view each thing differently.
You.
Right, but that's the point.
A personal basis, that's you. I'm talking about how society runs. Do you think society runs along the lines that you are thinking?
I think a lot of people, sure. Because I think that...
I didn't ask you about a lot of people. Do you think this society runs along the super simplistic analysis you just offered?
I do, yeah. I think people go about their day meeting people.
You hit you hit the nail on the head. As long as we choose to super simplify what is a complex society that took centuries to formulate how it wishes to operate and how its laws are to reflect what it thinks, what it wants, how it operates. As long as we have that, we can't get anywhere.
Well, can't we simplify life in the sense of
if yes, you'll have a simplistic life. Like we should all shake hands and be friends. Does that
make sense? Yeah, that's the way I choose to live life. Love each other.
Then that's you.
Treat each other how you want to be treated.
You are living, or you choose to live, a super simplistic life that has no bearing, no relationship, or very little of it, to what really exists and what people really contend with every single day.
Well, if
your choice
contend with the nature,
is to absent yourself and create an alternative reality.
Well, I'm not creating an alternative reality. It's my reality along with a lot of other people who live every day, meeting every person, treating them as an individual, love one another as you're supposed to, treat everybody how you wanted to be treated.
Oh, Lord, I'm getting bilious with this. This is not...
Get back to basics, it makes life a lot easier for everybody.
It's beyond super simplistic now. It's just silly. Mm-hmm. It has no bearing at all with the reality of this world and our place in it and how we struggle every single day to just have our humanity affirmed in the way that we affirm everybody else's humanity. It's not happening.
It kind of seems as if...
You have to excuse me from this conversation. It's getting me irritable. I cannot believe a grown person in these times in the United States of America chooses to be namby-pamby about the real situation on the ground. I just can't believe it, and I don't want to entertain it.
It doesn't fit your narrative. Your narrative is hatred. Your narrative is hatred. It doesn't fit your narrative.
You can say what you wish, but guess what?
Thank you. Thanks.
You can say what you wish, as will I. You have a problem with me saying what I wish?
No, I don't.
I'm saying your interpretation of the world. I think if you were to ask most people, just go out in your neighborhood and that. Well, no, probably they will reflect because I don't think you are likely to live in a very integrated community.
You assumed again in my mixed neighborhood that I'm in, you assume again, but you assume a lot of things about me. You're very negative or critical.
I assume that you are rude because it's come across that way. I assume that you're one of those provocateurs, or you try to be, but you have to
not
have common sense when you're a provocateur. You have to have intelligence when you're a provocateur. You don't yet qualify. Thank you. Thank you. Have a lovely, lovely day. Gwen from New York, you're on the air.
I'm so glad you ended that conversation, really. I mean, you know... I feel for you because I'm in a situation where I meet so many people where I am that have that simplistic way of thinking, and they have their little stats in their back pocket, and they know nothing because they don't want to know anything because it's very uncomfortable to know anything. And that's why she doesn't want you to be negative, what she calls negative. What she really doesn't want to hear is the truth. It's very uncomfortable. It hurts to listen to it. And I just wish that she would really... Before she gets on the radio, try to go out. You live in New York, and learn about what else is going on in the world besides your 10 friends you get together with on Friday and have a beer with. But that's not what I called about.
Great.
And I would love to talk about Chauvin, but I also want to talk about something that nobody's talking about. So I'm so glad the guy called for the clarification about the chest and being compressed, because I knew I was right the other day. So I got justified on that. But I also want to talk about this. I am a person who has seen a lot of shilly-shallying and bad deals being made by things called public-private partnerships. And usually the people that lose out are the public, not the private. So say a major company comes to your school and they want to put a soda machine in your school and they'll fix the roof for free, that means you have to capitulate and give them what they want. So I say that when it comes to public schools, keep it public and just take public money. I think that corporations and politics should stay separate, and they are not separate. They have been enmeshed together for years, and corporations have had huge, huge say-sos behind the scenes on how our society has shaped up, and it's usually for the good of the corporation. So when I heard this week, although I want to qualify this and I want to underline it 100 times, that I hate what Georgia has done with their laws. Okay, I think it's terrible. Oh. I think it should not be happening. And I think that we as citizens, all of us as individual citizens and groups and communities, should go after to make those laws be changed. It's a boatload of work. Stacey Abrams did so much work on it. But you can see when you do that much work that you can prevail. But you have to keep your nose to the grindstone. So when I heard all the corporations were jumping in to say that if Georgia, the state of Georgia, did not change the laws to the way they wanted them to, they were going to boycott, not put their business there. Well, in a way, I could understand that. The baseball team, okay, I think there is kind of some skin in the game. But I get really nervous when we start to take help from people that, for the most part, have really harmed many, many communities in America, especially Black communities and poor communities. So I don't really think they have a place at the table on this. I think that it's up to the people to decide on what the laws are going to be, even when the people have to work their heads off to change those laws. And the thing that makes me very suspicious here is, sure, they threw the first ball out and they're giving you what you want. They're going to crush the economy of Georgia if Georgia doesn't capitulate. But what are they going to do after this? Because this is the way corporations operate. And if you don't think I'm right, then take a look at these things called charter schools. They are for-profit schools. They dig around and search for money on Wall Street and where the biggest pots of money are in these public places. And they couldn't figure out for years and years and years how to get their nose into there. But they finally figured it out and they cracked the box open. And it's been a terrible thing that's happened to public schools, having to share their buildings with three other schools. And some of the kids get great stuff and some of the kids don't. You have fighting among the teachers. And the point I'm trying to make with you with on this is that I really think, like with religion, I think that religion and schools shouldn't mesh and religion and government shouldn't mesh. And I really, really get nervous about making the corporations the good guys. On MSNBC all this week, I heard how fabulous these corporations were and I heard how wonderful and humanitarian they were. And I thought, man, We are really lazy, because here's what happens when you allow them to take over. They'll take over everything. And people become very lazy and they become complacent again. And then they don't want to come out and vote. They don't want to change the government. They don't want to do the heavy lifting. That really is the only way to change and control your government, is to own your government. But I think if you turn the responsibility of how your government is run over to some corporations who tell you, look, yeah, we've come around, we see the light now, and we're going to take the lead on this. I feel very suspicious of this, and it makes me very, very nervous. If I could just add on one thing about the Chauvin thing, is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, I just want to say that I think that when it comes to the Chauvin trial, that E made so many great points the other day. I heard that it wasn't just that George Floyd and Eric Chauvin knew each other from a nightclub, that they worked together as bouncers for a year, but that Floyd actually had a job that was telling Chauvin what to do. And to me, this looks like such a setup, because Chauvin wasn't even there when they stopped Floyd. And when they finally got Chauvin there, he just jumped right on him. But the other thing was that the first cop that stopped him threatened him with a gun. Now, that's just really weird to threaten somebody with a gun. And that George Floyd knew from the get-go, from the very start, even when the guy waved the gun at him, he kept saying, don't kill me, don't kill me. I honestly think that he knew, it was almost like he had a hit put out on his life, and he knew that this was it. This is what he was going to run into. that's just my theory, just an idea. But I think that these people all knew each other, and I think that there's much, much more to the story than what we're hearing. This to me could not have been. There's no way. I mean, I work, you know, in cosmetics. I don't have to know somebody to speak to them to know who they are, and I don't see. I just don't see. This thing with Chauvin not being personal. I think it's really personal. And I think that when you're murdering somebody, it's super personal. And I think he knew George Floyd. And I think that probably the Minnesota Police Department does not want to have this come down as the police department knew. First of all, the police department is a vindictive order of our society that can go out and just kill people. So I think they're trying to, A, shut it down, B, consolidate it so not too many people poke around and ask any questions about the fact, and get it done and over with as soon as possible. Because I think that if you realize that this was George Floyd, but then you start asking, but how many other times has this happened? I think that it could end up maybe even being like a Serpico kind of thing. So
all right,
that's on my mind.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for today. But you said several mouthfuls that I think people need some time to digest. Thank you very much for your contribution today. Jeremiah, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today, Eutrice?
Okay, how are you?
Oh, fairly well, I would say.
Okay.
I'm going to try to my very best to stick to what I was originally calling about, because I feel inspired to respond to every previous caller and make a big mosh posh discussion. But have you heard any of the comments from Dr. Geert Vanderbosch?
No.
Are you familiar with Geert Vanderbosch? He's apparently a multi-PhD holding virology expert, and someone whose credentials just are, you know, beyond question in the subject of virology, epidemiology. And he issued a very polite, very professional declaration to the public and to the scientific world. And he said the vaccine program that's being implemented globally is extremely dangerous, and we might be opening a Pandora's box type of thing. And, you know, his explanation is very clear. I'm not an epidemiologist by any means to understand the full depth of the science of what he would explain to other professionals. But he basically said we need to have a public forum. All credible scientists or all credentialed scientists should be invited to the discussion, and the discussion should be completely available to the public. But something very dangerous is happening now, and we have to discuss it. And this doctor, Geert Vanderbosch, he's been, and I might be mispronouncing his name, he's been, you know, just completely swept to the side. And the general response has been, oh, well, he's just wrong about this. And, you know, what I've noticed is there's a few tiers of censorship going on right now in what I'm calling the emergence of the biosecurity state. That was my daughter.
Now, that is an opinion I happily endorse.
Yeah, she's she's very opinionated in an early age.
That's very good. Very good.
But basically the premise of what Dr. Vanderbosch seems to be saying, oh, I'm sorry, I was distracted by my daughter. I was saying previously that there seems to be like three tiers of censorship off the top of my head. One is if we can silence you all together, that's best. If no one hears what you have to say and it's outside of what we're trying to instill in the public, then that's number one, just silence you. Number two, if we have any grounds to call you crazy, a kook, a crackpot, a nut, what have you, we immediately identify that mark and start identifying you as quack, etc. And then number three, when you have people like Geert Vanderbosch who are a little harder to discredit, then it's, oh, well, he's wrong about this. We don't need to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just very alarming and very concerning, because obviously the whole COVID global pandemic, et cetera, everyone's concerned about mortality and health. But it's, I think, a known psychological fact that fear sometimes can interfere with a clear thought process, that you may perhaps make mistakes or do things in a panic state that you wouldn't do ordinarily. And, you know, these concerns that are being expressed, they may be right, they may be wrong, they may be partially right in a severe way, or maybe a not severe way. But these things should really be considered.
You realize, of course, that we are not used to that level of discourse. We're either you're right or you're wrong. We do not appreciate someone giving us a full view so that we can make up our own minds or that we can be more intelligent about a subject. We don't like that. We like to be told what to think. And there are systems in place that choose the preferred persons to come forward and tell us what to think. So you'd be surprised. I mean, I do a lot of reading, but I have not heard of the person that you just mentioned. I haven't. I wrote the name down.
It's VanderBossche. And it seems that the thrust of his concern seems to be that because this is a mRNA vaccine, this new type of vaccine that interacts with your genes or sends a synthetic RNA sequence to your DNA that gives the coded instruction, I guess you could say. The concern that he's expressing very specifically is if a person gets this vaccination and has not completed the immunological process and then somehow comes in contact with COVID, that this vaccine, which doesn't contain any of the actual virus, but just the signature protein spike of the SARS-CoV-2, will then be identified by the COVID when it enters your body. And the COVID is going to say basically, well, how'd you get that? Were you snooping around in my apartment? How do you have my protein spike? And he's saying right there in that interaction between the inoculated protein spike and the COVID itself, that's where some serious mutation can occur. And that's, you know, as far as the individual human subject. But then on a broad scale, he's saying you don't try to come up with an emergency vaccine during a pandemic. You need the pandemic to subside, and then maybe over a period of time you can create a vaccine. But by, you know, introducing a vaccine in an emergency manner such as this, you're stirring the viral pot. You're antagonizing the virome. You know, that's my understanding from what he's saying in layman's terms, which, you know, I don't claim to, again, any expertise whatsoever. But I also think it's important, you know, in this whole era where we're being deferred to experts all the time, to be more realistic and admit that, you know, frankly, I'm not going to be a virologist anytime soon. And I'm not going to be an epidemiologist. And I can't wait to be those things, to make personal choices in regard to my own health and the health of my family. So it's just kind of funny. Nowadays, a lot of people like to say, well, you're not a doctor, you're not a virologist, but I'm not administering medicine to people. I just need to make choices for myself. So,
well, this is the thing. In the midst of it all are people who don't know really which way to turn, because there's so many people trying to engineer your thoughts to compel you to pay attention to this or pay attention to that or to believe this or believe that. So I'm still in the reading and discovery stage, largely. I listen to what people are saying, and I try to see if I can catch up with what they're saying, because it's very complex. So you have a point here. Thank you so much for contributing today.
Thank
Veronica
you.
From New York, you're on the air.
Good day. Hello.
Hello, Veronica. You're on the air.
Good day. How art thou? I was calling to discuss how I felt about the 22 cases that was brought against Mr. Chauvin. And I felt that he should be able to serve at least a year for each one. And according to, I have a problem with the taxpayers' dollars that are being spent on the case for 13 lawyers and the police military budget that's presently paying them, the disrespectful leading questions, the complicit co-workers.
Wait a minute. You're giving us a smorgasbord of stuff. Which is your main point today?
Also, I know that if there was some justice, the fact that he has been accused and they would send him back on the street, they should also be in court, because they are just as complicit for sending this less than a human being out on the street every time that he had violated a human being and a human life.
All right. Well, hold on for a second.
Yes, ma'am.
Which is your topic today? What is the central point you're making today?
There are many things that have not been addressed, because the fact that that the ex-officer Chauvin would violate someone, he has almost caused so many deaths, and the fact that they would send him back out there, they need to investigate, they need to deal with the issue of the senior officers or the people who pushed papers that allowed him to continuously be back on the streets.
Okay, here's the thing I want you to appreciate. It's a trial. And by definition, the trial has to have a purpose. What is the purpose of the trial? The purpose of the trial is to try Chauvin for the death of George Floyd. That's the purpose of the trial. It can't be everything. That
right.
calls for separate trials. But you want everything piled in there, and your thinking seems to be, well, in as much as you're going to bring him to court, let him answer for everything since the day he was born. That can't be, as you know.
Well, if there was some equality in other cases, that's what has previously been done,
I don't know that you could say that. This is a clear-cut situation in which the case centers on the lethal interaction between Chauvin and George Floyd, resulting in the death of George Floyd, because Chauvin applied methods to kill him that are certainly not allowed according to police training. That's a trial, essentially. Now, you can't pile everything in there, because you may get nothing at all in terms of a conviction. You'll be all over the place.
Right. Those were things I wanted folks to think of, because it's very disturbing, just the fact that, his previous cases are not even thought of to, brought about for laying down the foundation of his mindset and how he was escalating to this behavior.
But they can't prove, they can't lump everything in. What I'm trying to say is,
I understand.
When you go to trial, you can't bring everything under the sun into the case.
You have to deal with this. That's right.
So you have to deal with this particular issue as a separate issue, and it as it is, it's way big enough to encompass a lot of other things, but it is on target as being a lawsuit, I mean a trial that puts Chauvin on point. He's a guy in the middle. He can't run away from these charges.
Right. I also wanted to mention something else as I'm freeing my mind. Throughout this COVID, it's being used as a covert issue to raising rent on the elderly and putting people out on the street for their property. I also wanted to mention that I was hoping that, being that we wanted automatics, if at all possible, Gloria Brown Marshall of Race, Law, and American Sovereignty Society could be brought on to your show as well, the professor of constitutional law. She was talking about the policies and so forth that has brought some of these racist issues into American politics.
Well, I thank you for bringing it to my attention. But I want you to concentrate, especially when we are dealing with freeing your mind. You want to have a streamlined topic that says, okay, I'm talking about X today. You're not talking about Y or A or B or C. You're talking about X. And give us a definitive position on that subject that we can kind of grapple with. Okay? Just try that for a minute. I understand the temptation because, believe me, I'm in the same boat. On any given day, you have 5 million things that you know need to be discussed, but you can't discuss them all at the same time. So you have to prioritize. And how about we try that you pick apart from your list your top subjects and then pursue them, bring them back and tell us why you want, so what you think about a particular subject and why. Is that doable?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate you.
All right. I look forward to hearing from you again really soon with the subject that you have thought a little bit more about in terms of how you can present it in a way that invites participation and reaction. Thank you so much for calling in today. I want to sell you.
Okay. Thank you, beloved.
All right. Thank you. Ali from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, you trees. How are you doing?
Okay. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing, you know, I'm waiting for the weekend and to get around positive people just like you.
That's right.
Yeah. But I have one comment, and then what I called for is about the situation with kneeling those knees, okay? But the first thing that I have to say is too bad that you don't have a voice recognition, because that woman, the second caller, she named herself Jerry, I think.
Jerry.
This time.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know about Jerry.
She calls all the time, and it's the same thing. And one of the sad thing about what she said was about Black. She, everything that she said negative, she emphasized Black people. Black people commit more crime, Black people this, Black people. It's just like when she was saying that, I wish you could just call her off, because she, it's not the first time, and she's going to continue using different names, and she's going to continue calling your show. And if she lives in New York, she must be in, and she said in a mixed community, it has to be that she's a gentrifier, because somebody like her will never have survived in a mixed community here in New York City.
I spotted Jerry from day one. From day one. So she's not a surprise at all.
Yes. Yes. But anyhow, what I called for, this is what I called for. About two nights ago, I received a picture on my phone. Somebody had made a poster, and the poster has in one side, it has Colin Kaepernick on one side, and they has the killing cop who was kneeling on George Floyd's neck. And the picture, whoever made that poster, it said, "Take a knee, America," okay? In one side was, you know, the football player, and the other side was the killer cop. And I'm calling because the significance of that. As you know, the football player, Kaepernick, he kneeled down, and the main thing was about police brutality, police abuse, and all the rest. Now we see this cop kneeling with his knee on this man's neck, and he killed him. And then every time that I hear all these things that is happening in that court case, I'm thinking about that the system is showing us, people of color, we destroy his professional life of this football player. And we could just go down and use one of our white supremacy and kill you with his knees. You see the parallel about these two things together? To me, it's unbelievable. It's incredible. Here is a young man fighting against the system. And he kneeled down. That's what he was doing. He kneeling down to prove a point. And this man, this cop, he used his knee to kill this man. I don't know if, and I said that before, if he's going to be found guilty or being found guilty of a lesser charge. But the parallel about the significance is just incredible.
Yes, it is.
It's like we cannot get up because they're going to get us no matter what. That's how I see it, and that's how I look at this.
Thank you, Ali, for calling in today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Brother David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm going to get right to the point. And my point is this. The people, the masses of people who live in America, they don't run the country. They don't run the country. So people have to get that through their heads, that this is a country that from its start, after it took over from the monarchy and created a slave republic, is run by a small group of people, the elite, the what we they call the ruling class, that run the country and as an empire run most, I think, of the world. And we have to get that and deal with that. So most people walking around thinking they go to vote and they have these two groups that are called parties, Republican, Democrat, or whatever. That's democracy. That's the last thing anyone who is running an empire would want, is democracy. And when I say they run this country, and I could go into detail about what they do to run it, but I won't do that. It'll take a lot of time. But they also run the world. So anyone that doesn't knuckle down is subject to sanctions, I guess thousands of sanctions to people in countries that don't line up and do what those in power want. So that is the important thing for people if they want to have a situation where they benefit, they're going to have to take leadership of the country from the ruling class that runs everything. Everything is rigged. The Congress, most of them are a bunch of crooks, and they have control of all the levels of information, and many people, even those walking around with one of those pile higher and deeper degrees, PhD, completely fooled by what's going on. The country, if the people want to live in a country that's a democracy, we have to make some big changes in what we are doing.
Well, you just had the last word, and I thank you. This was a brisk session. I want to encourage you more to kind of emulate the spirit of Ali and David. They don't mess around. They don't leave you wondering what it is they're thinking. It is important for you to get to that level of saying exactly what you think, but showing the mechanisms by which you have arrived at your conclusion. This is very, very good, very helpful, so that people can get a sense of how in a public forum you present your view. And your view is your view. But is it well thought out? Is it rational? Is it logical? Do you show any evidence that you've done some reading and you're putting things together in a way that you understand them perfectly? That is where we're going. I want to commend you all and thank you as usual for making me so proud to be in your company. And it is the weekend. Surround yourselves with people who bring positive dimension to your life and relax a little bit. Take some time to relax and decelerate. And we'll see each other on Monday, God willing, and the creek don't rise, as Maya Angelou used to say. God willing, and the creek don't rise. Bye-bye.